What were you doing on Thursday? Where were you? What were you doing on Thursday? Actually, let me just check. Have I got permission to ask you questions? Is that all right? Is anybody alive out there? Yes? Good. Good. So we like a bit of interactivity at East Hampstead Baptist Church. So you're invited to answer the question. Hands up, sort of a question. Can you remember what you were doing on Thursday? Thursday, the 4th of July, 1985, at about 7 o'clock. No? Honestly. You see, some of us have a mind like a steel trap. Others of us, maybe less so. Well, I know exactly what I was doing around about 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 4th of July, 1985. I know where I was. I know what I was doing. I was singing a song. It was the 4th of July, and the song I was singing is called Independence Day. Because if there's a song called Independence Day, you're going to sing it on the 4th of July, aren't you? And I was singing it with about 82,000 other people at the old Wembley Stadium. Some of you might not remember that there was an old Wembley Stadium, you know. And we're just glad you're here. We're glad you're here. If you're so young that you can't remember the old Wembley Stadium or 1985, we're glad you're here. If you were about 50-odd in 1985, we're really just glad you're here at all. So we don't want to hurry anyone into glory. But what was I doing singing that song with 82,000 people at the old Wembley Stadium? Do you remember the words in that little clip of God talking to Evan about the ark? And he said, you build it and I'll fill it. Well, some people built the old Wembley Stadium, twin towers at the front and all, no arch but towers. And somebody filled it on the 4th of July, 1985. Now, often in church, kind of quiz questions, the answer is Jesus. But I want to just give you a clue. The answer to this question is not Jesus. We could make a theological argument that Jesus did fill the stadium, but that's not the answer I'm looking for. Any offers? Who filled Wembley Stadium on the 4th of July, 1985, and began with Independence Day? Any offers? Oh, I'm hearing it. Bruce. Sounds like booing, but it's actually Bruce. It was Bruce Springsteen, arguably, and I'm going to argue, the greatest rocker of all time. And I've got some documentary evidence. I have my ticket here. Documentary. I have a paper to give evidence about the existence of Bruce Springsteen and what he was doing. And I have my own account, an eyewitness account. I could probably get hold of Dave Taylor, my schoolmate. We were 17, wide-eyed lads from Chester. We got the train. He could tell me about it. I could tell him. We could write our records down and we could put them with this ticket. And that would be a good and true record, wouldn't it? Well, moving on a few years, I wonder what you were doing on, let's see now, Sunday, July the 10th, 1988. Do you know what I was doing? I was singing a Bruce Springsteen song in Sheffield with probably about 50,000 that day. And I've got some evidence. I've got a paper that talks about that, and I have recollections of that all the way back from 1988, these old sort of 30-year-old papers. Now, here I've got a newspaper article. This one goes back to, 1993? It's a bit faded in the manner of old newspaper clippings. But it's very much legible. It's probably going to be legible for maybe 100 years or so, and then somebody might have to take a very careful copy, but it would still be true and accurate. And it speaks, "The boss gives his all." This is about a concert that took place in the Milton Keynes Bowl. And I have a ticket. Another paper, an old paper, which is my concert, because I was there. I was there. And if you want to have a look at the picture on it afterwards, the guitar that Bruce is holding might look a bit familiar if you come here when I'm leading worship. Not entirely a coincidence. But there's some more evidence that Bruce exists. He moved around. I could write my account. I could write the account of my friend Chris. I spoke with Chris yesterday, or texted him yesterday. He was there with me. I bought two tickets. And the first person said no, but with Chris, there were two things in his favour. A, he was a massive Bruce Springsteen fan, and B, unlike the first person, there was no danger that this might be a date. So he didn't turn me down, he came with me, we had a great time, and I've got that bit of evidence, and my personal recollection, the newspaper article, good evidence. Then moving forward, my lovely wife Claire treated me, June 2008, so this would have been a slightly belated 40th birthday present, hard to believe, 40th birthday present. The Millennium Dome in Cardiff, we were there, documentary, written, paper, evidence, and I could add my account and Claire could add hers. Now, would you think it fair to say that these separate bits of paper and kind of eyewitness accounts together created a compelling case for the existence of Bruce Springsteen and some of the things he did at certain times. Would that be fair to say? Yeah, is that fair? Because it's 30 years on from some of them. Is that still fair? Yeah. So if in, let's say, 2,000 years' time, somebody contested the existence of Bruce Springsteen, said he never existed, would it still be fair to say, even after that length of time, that these written papers and eyewitness accounts still would outweigh their protestations? Would it still be true, even all that time? Okay, what about this then? What if I created a scrapbook? There's nothing in the scrapbook. It's nice leather-bound sort of thing. And what if I decided to write down my recollections and put with them some of these papers, some of this documentary evidence, create a kind of a Bruce scrapbook? Would that, if I did that and put them all together and collated and curated that book and called it, I don't know, let's call it the new record, how about that? The new record of Bruce Springsteen. Would that diminish from the truthfulness of it, even though they were all together in one book, bound together? Would that, no? I want you to really remember that, because that is kind of the story of how the Bible came to be put together. Not a scrapbook about a very good, I would argue, best rock and roller, but about Jesus, about God. People sometimes say that you can't use the Bible to verify what's in the Bible. Don't stand for it. It's not a book. It's not. I know it looks like a book, but it's a collection of historical writings that verify each other and all come together. And because they were verified at the time and other papers rejected because they were not truthful, that's why we have the Bible, the B-I-B-L-E, as it is today. Don't let anyone tell you that you can't use what's in the Bible to verify what's in the Bible. It's a collection. It's a library of books. It's not just to be thought of as a book. Just as I've got a collection of documents over there, so I have here. So Steph was talking last week about what makes up the New Testament part of the Bible. A collection of ancient writings that came about because, in the case of the New Testament, because of an incredible event, far more incredible than the fantastic concert I went to see. The resurrection of Jesus. A man called Jesus predicted his own death and resurrection 3 days later, and he pulled it off. And that is an event worth writing about. So some of his followers, the Apostle Paul, we've come to know him as, wrote lots of letters, about half the New Testament part of the Bible, half the books or thereabouts in the New Testament. And eyewitnesses like a guy called John, Matthew, who were among the first disciples of Jesus, wrote their accounts of his life. And others wrote careful accounts with eyewitness testimonies in them. And more letters were written, and they were all pulled together. Now, at the time that these letters and writings were going out, it was the time of the Roman Empire, and you weren't supposed to worship or bow to anyone except Caesar. So they had to be kept a little bit in the dark, but carefully preserved away from each other. Until the day came when the persecution lifted, and those trusted letters and biographies, writings about Jesus and the church began to grow and be collated together, the New Testament. But what about the Old Testament? What about the Old Testament? Surely, Simon, that's not the same. Surely you can't take that literally, because we have these, okay, we have these biographies, eyewitnesses, but that's not true of, surely that's not, what about the Old Testament? You don't take it literally, do you? Well, we all like to think that we're reasonably intelligent, I guess. We don't like to believe in things that we can't square in our rational minds. We want to accept things that are truthful, but not to dismiss our common sense at the same time. But the resurrection of Jesus, attested to by many witnesses, compelled people to believe things that maybe they wouldn't do otherwise. So they began to get interested in the backstory of a particular Jew, Jesus. And the backstory of the Jewish nation. And that is the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, the Jewish Bible. They were interested in the backstory of this amazing man. So that is to say, for our Bible today, which contains both the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Old Testament was kind of added to, pre-existing, but added to the New Testament writings to create a whole story of God fulfilled in Jesus. But let's get back to the question. Simon, you don't take that literally, do you? Sure, the New Testament, fine, but surely not the Old Testament. I mean, the New Testament, yeah, letters and writings and accounts and history, we can believe that. We can even cross-check it with things that aren't contained in that collection in the New Testament. Roman writings and so on. But it's not the Old Testament, Simon. What about the story of Noah's Ark? So do we take that literally? What about the creation story? 6 days and then he rested, is that right? What about Jonah being swallowed up by a whale and spat out? Do we take it literally? Well, since the very early days of the Christian church, these questions have been asked. They're not new questions. We might struggle with them today, but people have struggled with them for 2,000 years. In the very early days of the church, these questions were wrestled with. Some people said, well, the Old Testament is incompatible with the New Testament, so we shouldn't pay attention to it. A guy called Marcion was of that view, and he kind of picked and chose letters and writings from the New Testament, that collection of documents, and said, well, let's go with this, but we must dismiss the Old Testament writing. It's not compatible with Jesus, he said. And that was dismissed very early on, the first couple of centuries after Jesus. Dismissed as heresy, untrue, incorrect, dismissed by the greatest theologians of the age. So when we think of these questions today, just know that they've been wrestled with long, long ago and by the greatest minds and much, much closer to the time of Jesus. We ought to know too that if we're wanting to dismiss the Old Testament, well, maybe we ought to take a look at what Jesus said about him. Maybe, if you're not yet sure about Jesus, if you're just exploring faith, well, stay with this. This might just be interesting. But if you would say that you're a Christian, follower of Jesus, then you really ought to know what Jesus had to say about the Old Testament, which he would have had, the Hebrew Bible. Let's just look at a couple of readings from Matthew's account of Jesus' life. Some people argue that Matthew wasn't Levi, the apostle, the disciple, one of the first 12. I kind of think he was, but let's have a look what he said. This is Jesus saying this now in quotes. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets, the Old Testament books of the Bible. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Don't change a word of it, he says. And then he also says this, just later on in Matthew's account. He's being put to task by religious leaders, Jewish religious leaders, who knew all about, of course, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. That's what they had. That was their holy book. So hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees and the Pharisees got together. Sorry, had silenced the Sadducees, one religious group, the Pharisees, another religious group, who really abided closely to the law and the prophets, they got together. And one of them, who was an expert in the law, tested him with this question. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Trying to catch Jesus out. Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Quoting from the Hebrew Bible, Deuteronomy. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. This from Leviticus. Love your neighbor as yourself. And then he rounds up, and we need to hold on to these words when we have confusing passages that we struggle with in the Old Testament. He says this, all the law and the prophets, all of that, hang on these two commandments. So if we've got confusion, if we're not sure, love God and love people. Oh, that sounds familiar. If you've been around EBC for any length of time, you'll know that that is our purpose statement, our reason as a church to be church together. Love God, love people, and we grow together to become more like Jesus, who gave us those two things as the entirety summed up of the law and the prophets. So we must accept that that's what Jesus said. Can't just dismiss or change what the Old Testament said. So are we to take it literally? Come on, Simon, you're ducking the question. You've talked about the New Testament, but Steph did that last week. She's going to do it again this week. Come on, talk to us about the Old Testament. Do we take it literally? Well, here I got some help. One of my hobbies, one of my pastimes, I like to listen to theologians debating and talking. And one of them is a guy, American guy called R.C. Sproul, now gone to glory. And I think was a fantastic teacher. And he addressed this question head on. He said that he used to get asked this question. In fact, he'd be asked it as a statement followed by a little sarcastic question. People would say to him, R.C., you don't read the Bible literally, do you? And he said that he always gave the same answer. It was never yes, never no. And people said to him, you don't read the Bible literally, do you? He would say, of course, like duh, of course I read it literally. But then he went on to explain. And that really set me free in my thinking. And I hope it gets you thinking too. What does the word literally mean? Let me just let that soak in for a second. What does the word literally mean? It means as it was written. As it was written. So what was the intention? What were the circumstances when things were written? And how might we understand them in the light of those circumstances? What was the mode of writing? Let me help you with a couple of examples here. Let's talk about Proverbs for a second. Not Proverbs in the Bible, but I can thoroughly recommend you read Proverbs in the Bible. Let's think of an easy, and again, I'm borrowing from R.C. Sproul for this one. Let me give you a proverb that we can probably all relate to. Here's one. He who hesitates is lost. We all know what that means, don't we? It's akin to carpe diem, seize the day. The moment is ripe, you've got to get it before it's gone. He who hesitates is lost. Well, let me give you another one. Look before you leap. Hang on. You just said he who hesitates, it's incompatible. But we know what it means. We know the truth of each of those things, don't we? They're addressing different sets of circumstances, aren't they? So they're simultaneously true, and yet put together they seem to oppose each other. Because the context matters. And they're proverbs, it's a style of writing, and that matters too when we want to understand what the writer was getting at. Let me give you another illustration. One of my other hobbies or pastimes is I like poetry. Honestly, I'm not making this up. I'm a poetry lover. And one of the poets I rather like is a Scottish poet, you may have heard of him, called Robert Burns. Yes? He wrote a great poem which is full of truth. It tells me a lot about Robert Burns. It goes a bit like this. My heart's in the Highlands. My heart is not here. My heart's in the Highlands, chasing the deer. Chasing the wild deer and following the roe. My heart's in the Highlands, wherever I go. Isn't that lovely? It tells us a lot about Robert Burns. But here's what it doesn't tell us. It does not tell us something about the strange and mysterious anatomy of Robert Burns, that somehow he was in one place and his disembodied heart was in the Highlands of Scotland running around chasing deer. We know it doesn't mean that, don't we? Because it's written in the style of poetry. So what it tells us is not some weird thing about his physiology. It tells us that he loved Scotland. He loved the Highlands deeply. It tells us in a way that is far more powerful and meaningful than if he simply wrote, I love the Highlands. Do you understand? We're reading it literally, as it was written. poetry. Context matters. Style of writing matters. Reason for writing matters. And the Old Testament matters. It really matters. Jesus said so. It introduced a different way of thinking, radically different way of thinking about God. One God. It answers the questions that science can't answer. It tells us about our reason for existence, about how the world came into being and why. It gives us purpose and meaning in life. Why am I here? Why is there anything here? Why is there a universe here? What caused it to begin? Science catches up with the Bible. My scientific friend Peter and I were talking about this the other day. He's a scientist. I have some interest in science. Don't worry about science. Some people make a god of science. And sometimes Christians can be on the defensive. Science just helps us to understand how God does things and did things. Yeah? Science catches up. So we now know, scientists used to think, atheistic science, that the universe was eternal, had always existed. But with the Big Bang theory, it seems that the universe had a beginning. Science has now caught up with the Bible. That tells us that God created the world, the universe, in the beginning. Yes, science catches up. It has a way of catching up with what we knew from the Bible anyway. In Jesus, the Old Testament writings are completely fulfilled. We're not to set it aside, but it's still tremendously valuable. One of the great scholars of the Old Testament, one of these Pharisees, one of these people who tried to abide by the law, was this guy Paul, Saul of Tarsus, used his kind of Roman version of his name, Paul, when he encountered Jesus and his life was transformed. And he wrote this. Let's have the next slide up, please, Kim. He wrote this in a letter to somebody called Timothy, who he was bringing on to lead a church that he'd helped to found. All scripture is God-breathed and useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness, so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. Now, you may have questions about the Bible. You may have particular questions about the Old Testament part of the Bible. And I just want to say to you, that's good. That's a good thing. Come to those questions with faith in Jesus and wrestle with God before God on those questions. You may never get to the answer. It may take you a lifetime of wrestling. And then when you die, you can ask him. That's the challenge. Wrestle with these questions. But don't be arrogant. I don't want to be arrogant, and I just invite you as well. Don't think that you're asking new questions that smarter people than me, and dare I say you, have wrestled with centuries and centuries and centuries earlier. Deep, deep thinking philosophers, deep thinking theologians much nearer the time. Don't think it new. Get before God and wrestle with these questions. The Bible, ta biblia in Greek, the books, not the book, the books, they wouldn't even be collected here and collated together were it not for Jesus and what he did and said he was going to do, his resurrection. It led to those letters and biographies being written and then collated and then having the Hebrew Bible added, the Old Testament, to it. So we can have different ideas about those writings. Not so much in the New Testament, but in the Old Testament, we can say, well, okay, what styles are they? And we can disagree about that. Some might be allegory, some might be poetry, some might be historical narrative, some might be poems and songs, some might be a view about certain events written much later on. But those are arguments between friends, if we accept that Jesus is who he said he is, and if we accept his teaching. And actually, Paul's about how useful and valuable and not to be changed or set aside the Old Testament is. Ultimately, if we are Christians, we need to take it seriously because Jesus said so. And that's kind of the final word on it, really. You can choose to accept Jesus or not, but if you do, then you have to accept what he said about the Old Testament. It's not to be set aside. And I want to invite you to build into your life some time to read it, New Testament and Old Testament. Maybe start with the Gospels, the stories about Jesus' life and teachings in the New Testament, but maybe find something in the Old Testament to attach to. And Fiona's got, as I say, a wealth of resources for you to look at. I love Proverbs. I find that incredibly helpful to me in my life in general. I find God speaks to me through those Proverbs that were written so, so long ago. So long ago. So build in some time to wrestle with these questions and to find wisdom and find inspiration and find hope and ultimately find Jesus. Build in that time into your life. And if you build it, he'll fill it.